The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning, Reading, and the rest of the world. Wow.
Bill got up early. He ate Wheaties.
I ate my Wheaties. Something. Drank my coffee.
Oh, that's what probably did it.
I'm rip-roaring ready to go.
Oh, boy.
Well, welcome, everybody. Good morning, Bob. Morning, Aaron.
Morning, Bill. Morning, Aaron.
John Boy. Mary Ellen.
Hey, welcome to We the People Radio.
It's crying to be said.
We're chatting and streaming live. Give us a call if you want to join the chat. WeThePeopleRadio.us is where you can join the chat and
learn about our guest.
Yeah, learn about our guest.
A lot of good intel there.
Have a link there. You can download all the pertinent information. And join us. Give us a call, 605-4567, if you'd like to join in with the conversation.
Yeah, you can send us questions over the chat. You can send us questions over the phone. Or you can just listen. Since it's Sunday, we don't want to put any pressure on you, but it is Super Bowl, so I guess
Yeah, you're gonna have to get all those little smoky weenies on the barbecue or whatever it is
you're doing.
Yeah,
I don't even know who's playing. That's how much I'm into it.
Seattle Seahawks and Denver Broncos.
They're playing in New York. I knew where they were playing. I just didn't know who was playing.
I guess
I should remember the Seattle thing. That was the guy who was rude a couple weeks ago, and isn't that the rude guy?
Oh, Richard Sherman. Yeah.
Okay, there you go.
It's going to be a chilly game, I know that. It's going to be a little cold.
Well, some say he was rude. Some say the reporter just caught him at a moment when he was still pumped full of adrenaline right after he made the play that won the game.
It's too bad I can't make a play that wins a game and I could say something bad like that and blame it on adrenaline. That would be awesome.
I wish I could just get some adrenaline. I don't seem to have much of that anymore. I guess it's a age thing.
Don't give it all away.
Super Sunday is appropriate for our lineup here at KCNR. We're making some changes today.
Oh, yes, we are.
Oh, yeah. Go into that, Bob, since you're the producer guy and all that.
Tell everybody what
we're Sovereign,
doing.
Sovereign Minds is now on Sunday morning, effective today, immediately following We the People. Sovereign Minds with Mark and Linda Kent, formerly heard on Saturday mornings. That slot, 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, has now been, or is now occupied, you'll pardon the expression, by
we'll let that go.
Jefferson State of Mind. Jefferson State of Mind is the name of the program. Red Smith and Caleb Brown are the hosts, and they talk all things State of Jefferson every week, and they got off to a terrific start yesterday.
Nice!
See, I could have never said all that. That was great.
And the Don Shulman Show is now back in its original time slot, 11 to 1 on Sundays.
You know, it's funny. I was wondering about that. I thought that's when he usually aired. And what's the commercial say? What's wrong with that man?
Is there something wrong with him?
Is there something wrong with him?
Clearly.
Oh, my gosh. That's the funniest commercial. Okay. So we'll fun up our commercial. Bob has to take clips and invent commercials every week. We're really going to actually do a good job. Hey, you want to call Jim?
Sure, why not?
All right. He just emailed me and wanted to know if we were calling him. And I said, sure.
Jim, we'll give you a call.
Sure, Jim. Okay, so we'll...
I was mentioning to you, he was, I think it was Thursday night on our broadcast of Dennis Miller. Jim was on there touting his book for about 15 minutes, so we'll tell him he has a much longer segment with We the People than he had with Dennis Miller.
See? You know what? And we're a much bigger program than Dennis Miller, obviously. And Dennis Miller and I have the same Christmas habit. Because Bill always makes fun of me that it's not Christmas. I can't decorate the tree unless I watch Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
That's the old one. I heard him talking about that.
Yeah, with Burl Ives.
That's right.
And he's like, it's the ultimate Christmas movie. It's not Christmas unless you watch it. I thought, that's what's wrong with me. See?
And that we almost lost Christmas this year because I could not find the video. I had to go out and spend 3 hours looking for the DVD of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
I decorate the tree while I watch Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
I'm not going to decorate the tree, so 3 hours of looking for this DVD.
I even have little characters from Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the original movie, to decorate the house with.
Silver and gold, silver and
If you can't do it right, don't do it at all.
Don't make fun of Burl.
I love Burl Ives. Anyway, as far as I know, he didn't do anything bad. You know, it seems like everybody you find out, you know, they're a heinous liberal or they were like, you know, Woody Allen, everything we always thought that was wrong with him was. And
yeah, we're afraid to ask.
Yeah, yeah. You know, something like that. Anyway. Hey, so let me do the promo on Jim while Bob's teeing him up on the phone there. Let's see. James V. Lacey. He's a third-generation native Californian. He's born in Oakland. Graduate of Bellarmine College Preparatory in San Jose. Received an undergraduate at UCLA. His JD from Pepperdine University School of Law at Malibu. He was admitted to law practice in California and also the District of Columbia. Serves as a member of the board of visitors at Pepperdine University. Delegate from California to the 1976 Republican Convention. So that kind of gives you an idea about how long he's been in politics. So he's been in politics since I was freshman in high school?
Yeah.
Yeah, freshman in high school. Freshman. You what, graduated?
I was in the eighth grade.
You liar.
I'm just a pup.
Liar.
I'm a pup.
You're an old man. So
I'll never
tell. It's too late. I already helped you out. Let's see. So he served as an aide to Howard Jarvis, the author of Prop 13. He worked for the Reagan election in 1980, and after Reagan won the presidency, he joined the administration in Washington, D.C., where he served for Reagan's entire term, including as a senior advisor to the Commerce Department and general counsel to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. So pretty good stuff, okay? The thing that caught our eye and wanted to have him on is Mr. Lacey has written a book called Taxifornia. I like the subtitle, actually. Liberalism is to blame for California's rotting economy. I'm sorry, that's not the right subtitle. It's Liberals' Laboratory to Bankrupt America. That's the part I like that I posted all over Twitter last night. So anyway, how are we doing? Do we have Jim trapped in the...
Jim trapped.
Hello. Yes.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Happy Super Bowl Sunday.
Yeah, we just figured out who was playing. We're obviously gigantic football fans. We knew where they were playing, but not exactly who. Bob was in charge of that. So you're joining us here on We the People this morning to get a longer segment than you had on Dennis Miller, although we love him. But I guess you had to cram it all into 15 minutes.
Yeah, he had three or four people on that day, so we went whatever the equivalent was of a guest segment there. There was like one commercial interruption, and then we had the opportunity to talk. It was an interesting interview in that Dennis Miller is rather skeptical about the future of California. Mm. If you heard what he had to say, it was that he was becoming disengaged and that he had his doubts about the future, and that's a sad statement coming from such a smart person and someone who obviously contributes to the tax base here in the state, but it's all too frequently heard from high-income, high-achieving individuals as a result of this last round of tax increases that the Liberal Democrats have put in. You know, the Proposition 30 tax increases that were voted on by the people in 2012, supported by the governor and the Liberal Democrats, did a couple of things. One of them was is that they lifted state income tax to the highest levels in the nation. And those state income taxes were made retroactive for the entire year of 2012. So people who actually are high income earners really got nailed. But the issue of taxes in California isn't something that just affects high income earners. It also is having really a devastating effect on poorer people. Since Prop 30 passed, the poverty rate in the state of California has been lifted to the highest level in the nation for 2 years running. It's a really sad statement with all the riches and all of the wonder that California has, with all of the potential, that we are the poorest state in the nation now 2 years running, and it's because of taxes. These consumption taxes, like the highest state sales tax and the highest gas tax in the nation. And you can understand it certainly being near Oregon where there isn't a state sales tax. The fact that our state sales tax is the highest in the nation is just pushing poor people into poorer categories. It's making the poor poorer. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that I wrote Taxifornia was to call out the Liberal Democrats on this policy and the fact that while they think that they're raising money to help the kids, quote-unquote, they're really not. What they're doing is pushing the state deeper into poverty, causing businesses that create jobs to flee. And in the meantime, they're not even using the tax revenue for the kids. Dan Walters, who is a journalist with the Sacramento Bee, wrote just last week that we didn't need Proposition 30, as it turns out, because the economy would have lifted up revenues enough, and the money isn't being spent to help the kids. It's being spent on prisons, it's being spent on more welfare, and it's being spent to hike state public employee union salaries, and that's coming from a neutral observer. That's not me. That's Dan Walters.
Well, that's always the case when they tout it's for the schools, it's for the kids. They get it passed, and then guess what? It's not going there. They did the same thing with the lottery.
Yeah, the lottery was supposed to be a completely dedicated new source of funds, supplemental to education,
exactly.
And it isn't.
No,
it's been
not.
Stepped on. And then, of course, we passed a proposition years ago, I think it was Proposition 98, that requires that 37% of the state budget be dedicated to schools, whether they need it or not. Californians have been very generous with the schools. Over the last years, we've passed maybe 25 to 30 different state bond measures to build schools. Localities are constantly passing bond measures to help schools. What these politicians are doing to the state of California, and they're liberal Democrats, and Jerry Brown is the leader, but it's not just off on Jerry Brown. The public employee unions put these people in power, and they tell them to do this, and they go forward and they raise our taxes and they say it's for the kids, and it's a lie. There's no question it's a lie. Dan Walters says it's a lie. It's a lie. And my book, Taxifornia, is about giving people the facts to understand that.
Yeah, because we always hear a slightly different twist. There were the part on the website that we, I'm using the term we loosely, that Robert Exter, our great web builder there, that he included, there was one part I copied and underlined for today, one short paragraph. California has an outdated environmental policy. I'd like you to go through that. And then the one sentence, the public employee union worker who controls traffic at the BART maintenance yard in poverty-stricken and near bankrupt Oakland is paid more annually than the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. What is wrong with that picture?
You know, when President Obama and his administration announced a few months ago that they were going to start to focus on the issue of income inequality in the United States, I just laughed to myself. I thought to myself, wait till they get to California and start a debate about income inequality, because here's the rub. There are people who are doing well in California today in the Silicon Valley, the innovators, and of course some of the people in the entertainment industry. Some industries are coming back a little bit. California unemployment is still terribly high. It's 8.3%. It's almost 20% higher than the rest of the nation. But we have this persistent high poverty rate. And in the Central Valley, going up to Highway 5, up to lovely Redding and Mount Shasta, we have some areas that are well over 10% unemployment, right? So we still have a state that's in distress financially. Another statistic, we have the second highest distressed job rate in the nation. That means that people who do have jobs may be holding on to them tenuously, right? So we have this situation where we're really not out of recovery. We're lagging in recovery. People are hurting. The taxes are hurting. They're forcing people deeper into unemployment and deeper into poverty. Yet, our public employee union sector seems to be doing really well. I live in a Southern California county where the average pay for a firefighter in 2012 was $234,000. Now, I don't begrudge a firefighter for getting a good salary, and I think they should be able to get an adequate pension because they work hard. But we have to ask ourselves, when the average salary in the state is about $52,000 for a family of four, when we have almost 24% of our population at the poverty rate, that's $23,000 or less, is a public employee union safety salary of $234,000 justified? Is it right? The worst example of all of this are the pay scales at BART. And that foreman of that union yard, who is a member of the SEIU public employee union, did get paid $271,000 in 2012 to watch the trains go in and out of the maintenance yard and to push a few buttons. And, you know, it's worse. Let's talk about BART for a second. Even before they went into this last round of negotiations for their current contract, the woman who was paid to sit in the booth at the Fremont station to watch for jumpers, those are, you know, that's basically the information booth that they have at the BARTs. It has all this bulletproof glass,
oh, yeah,
and you wonder
yeah.
why the person's even there. That person got paid $150,000 to sit there and watch for jumpers.
So people like leaping over that didn't put their little card in?
Correct. Okay. $150,000 for that person to sit there. A janitor
Whoa.
At BART got paid $90,000. And that's in comparison to the same job by a janitor over in San Mateo County working for the county that got paid maybe $60,000, $65,000. So they don't use comparative data. They don't use rational business tools to try and judge who should get paid what and what the salary should be. And the problem is that the public employee unions like the SEIU and the California Teachers Association have these very vigorous political action committees, and they raise just crippling amounts of money in terms of campaigns so that they get their friends elected to these offices. And when they do their contract negotiations, they're basically negotiating with themselves. It's all a charade for the press because they know that they're going to be able to get conciliatory contracts. The recent BART contract lifted those wages from the prior contract between 9 and 11% over the next 3 or 4 years. So that fellow that got the $271,000 in 2012, he's probably going to be making over $300,000 at the end of the contract. Can you believe that?
No.
And with the pension, and this is taxpayer money.
Yeah.
With the pensions that they get on top of that, is it no wonder that the fares go up, that the boards of directors of these entities like BART ask taxpayers to pay more in taxes? Is it any wonder? Well, of course it's no wonder. The whole system isn't geared towards helping the people. The problem with government today, and let me just say this, the problem with government today increasingly is that it's not serving the people for police, fire, and public safety. The principal purpose of local government today is increasingly becoming taking care of the pensions of past employees.
Exactly. Hey, Jim, we're going to have to take a break real quick, but when we come back, I'm glad you brought up the issue of the teachers union. I'd like you to touch on that again in light of the new preschool teachers they're going to be bringing on and really what that's all about.
Yeah.
Not what you might think. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you guys are going to all need more coffee or maybe less. And I want you to all put your pitchforks and torches in the closet. Otherwise, we'll be running around the street today. We're going to need to burn off some fuel on... maybe we'll watch the Super Bowl after all. All righty, we'll be back with you. We're speaking with Jim Lacy, author of Taxifornia. And we're going to be talking about some taxifornia here this morning, all the way up till 10 o'clock. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, the home of Free Fire Media.
Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
Welcome back, everybody. We are speaking to Jim Lacey, author of Taxifornia. And what really is going on in California with our economy, our taxes, and where we're headed and what we can do about it.
And the subtitle for the book, Liberals' Laboratory to Bankrupt America. Can't miss that.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about the BART situation and also the teachers. Jim, why don't you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Well, the state of California has become a leader in a negative way. You know, in the past, we've been a leader in technology with Silicon Valley. We've been leaders in fashion. We've been leaders in education with the tremendous University of California system and the tremendous state university system that we have. But our leadership is changing in much more negative ways. We're now the leader in income taxes with the highest income taxes in the nation. We're now the leader in state sales taxes with the highest state sales taxes in the nation, highest gas tax. And now we're leading in a different way. We are at the bottom rung of student test score achievement in the nation. Our fourth graders, for example, are scoring, depending upon what report card you look at, between 46th and 48th in the critical skills of math and reading.
And Common Core will fix all that, though, won't it?
We're basically at the lowest. We're close to some of the southern states that have always been challenged. Our test scores on average aren't much different from Mississippi's, and Mississippi's always been near the bottom rung. It's just a travesty that we would have these poor test scores while at the same time teacher pay ranks at the highest in the nation. In the last few years, the teacher pay in California has either scored first in the nation, second, or third, again, depending upon what survey you look at. And the average salary for a teacher in the state of California is close to $70,000 a year for 9 months' work. There's clearly a disconnect there. I think any rational person might ask themselves, how could teacher pay be at the highest in the nation where student achievement scores are at their lowest? And, you know, as we were saying earlier, it's not for want of spending on students. Californians are very generous. We have passed the lottery to give money to the schools. We have passed a proposition that dedicates over a third of the state budget to schools. Localities have been generous. They've passed parcel taxes in many communities, which provide additional taxes for schools. Heck, the CTA has the Parent Teachers Association convinced that they should go out and do fundraising for the local schools when they really don't need it. The California is a very big state, and so the liberals will come back and say, well, the per pupil expenditures are not above the average, they're below the average. But, you know, that's not the point of how you get a good education. I want to tell you, there's a liberal out there named Amanda Ripley, who is an award-winning author with Time Magazine, and she's written a book called The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way. And in her research, she went all around the world. She looked at something called the International PISA test and studied how kids who score highly on these international tests are educated in their own home countries. And what she found was it wasn't how much money that was spent per pupil. What mattered was tests that were meaningful. In other words, like taking a test to graduate from high school before you can graduate from high school as a motivation device for the kid. So meaningful tests are the first thing. The second thing is having a teacher who's engaged, who actually cares. And I don't think that we can say across the board that we don't have great teachers in California. We do. There are plenty of teachers out there. I had good teachers in the public school system that I was in. That I remember and that I recall and that did a great job. But the reality is today that the California Teachers Association has highly politicized the profession of teaching, and everything becomes a work rule, including teacher evaluations. And so we have a situation where, to the extent that we have bad teachers that are not motivating kids and not helping to lift test achievement scores, that we can't get rid of them and move them around or get them training, because it's now all work rules, and it's binding arbitration and having hearings and so on. And it results in some ridiculous outcomes, including the fact that in the L.A. school system, you've probably read about this, they had this pervert who was a teacher down there that did terrible things in the classroom with his kids.
Can you say
they finally figured out a way to take him off the job, but now he's going to get a pension on top of everything that he did. The fellow should have been summarily dismissed and put in some sort of a jail for what he did. But the CTA is standing behind him, even though he was involved in what amounted to sex crimes in front of these kids, and he's going to go ahead and he's going to get his pension for the rest of his life. You know, it's a system that desperately needs reform. And interestingly enough, there are Democrats out there that want to reform it. Gloria Romero, who's a former Democratic state Senate leader, has gotten involved in this and is favoring education reform in the form of merit pay and using student achievement tests as a way to cull through the teachers and to determine, separate the good from bad. And also Michelle Rhee, whose husband is the Democrat mayor of Sacramento, has a group called Students First, and they're trying to do similar reforms, but the Liberal Democrats hate them. Daryl Steinberg and the Liberal Democrats at the last Democrat state convention earlier last year passed a resolution vilifying those other two Democrats for even thinking about reforming education. The reason is because the California Teachers Association put the kibosh on it.
Yeah, and the Teachers Association, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of great teachers out there, but the union has become so powerful and has got so much money to throw at these politicians. How do you break that grip? Because that's really what it's about. It's about the money. And they have to realize that, you know, people have to realize that throwing more money at this issue is not going to fix it. It's just absolutely making it worse. So,
let's focus on the money aspect for a second, because you raise really a critical point that I raise in Taxifornia, and I have a chapter where I go into some detail about the political money and how it's affecting all of our lives as a result of it. Because the teachers' union not only is trying to keep control of the teaching profession, but they're also trying to create other policy outcomes as well. These statistics are astounding, and I have a chart in the book. Since the year 2000, the California Teachers Association alone has spent $290 million on politics in the state of California. That's to elect people to public office and to lobby for legislation. At $290 million, the teachers union is the largest special interest in the state. Now, some people might have an idea that the oil companies are the biggest special interest in the state because of all of the oil wells throughout the state and because of all the money that's involved with oil. Or some people might think that the tobacco lobby is the biggest special interest in the state and that they have reasons to be concerned about state laws. I've got to tell you, as we have in our book, the California Chamber of Commerce spends one-fifth on politics in the state since the year 2000 that the California Teachers Association has. The California Teachers Association is two or three times bigger than the oil company lobbying in the state. They're two or three times bigger than the tobacco lobbying. And when you add the Service Employees International Union spending, which is at about $180 million over the same period of time, and the Prison Guards Union, it's a $500 million since 2000 just on politics. Well, what they're doing is they're putting people in office and they're perpetuating them there. And it's little doubt that Liberal Democrats control two-thirds of the Assembly, two-thirds of the State Senate. All eight of our statewide constitutional officers are controlled by Liberal Democrats. The Teachers Association spent $5 million to help get Jerry Brown elected governor this last time around. They spent $2 or $3 million to help get the superintendent of public instruction elected. And the reality is that it's almost impossible to compete with those funds. Some teachers pay as much as $1,000 a year in political dues.
Wow.
Now the California Teachers Association has about 325,000 members. They have some allied unions. There's a California Federation of Teachers, which is allied with the CTA. They're mostly in Southern California, so they add members. And, of course, the Service Employees International Union is a very, very big union with many, many members. So, you know, one question would be, well, how do we offset those of us who care about this country and who don't share those political beliefs? How do we offset this political spending? I have to say, it's been pretty hard. The state of California has tried two or three times to pass so-called paycheck protection initiatives because the legislature won't pass it, and these paycheck protection initiatives basically would say that these unions can't mandatorily impose these political dues on their members, but they've always lost the initiatives because the unions spend so much money to defeat them. They always poll well up until election day, and then the unions just spend a ton of money to defeat it.
So
in my book, I don't call for more paycheck protection type rules, but I think if there's a general understanding that starts to develop among the electorate that the California Teachers Association is a special interest and that it has its own selfish interests that it's trying to impose upon the rest of the state, maybe attitudes can change.
Hey, Jim, yeah, we're going to take a break, but I think what I hear you saying is this whole preschool, adding more teachers, isn't really about fixing the poor education that the kids are getting. It's more about adding to their numbers and adding to the amount of money they have to throw around politically.
What a good idea. Take it from the taxpayer and give it to the guys who are going to keep the bad guys in power.
Yeah,
awesome.
And all in the name of the kids. I like that part.
Yeah, exactly. If they could throw in puppies, they would. Hey, we'll be back with you in 2 minutes. Take a quick break. Thank our advertisers. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be back with you here at KCNR 1460 AM or not. Bob is shaking his head. He's shaking his head a different direction. Yeah. We're definitely coming back now.
We're going to go take our blood pressure medication right now and be right back.
Bill.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And on my lack of education, I can read the writing on the wall.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control. No dark side.
It's good thing it's radio.
Yeah, it's radio. You can't see Aaron dance in the wing.
Hey, teacher, leave my wallet alone.
All right, we're back.
Okay, we're back. I can stop singing now.
Yes, stop doing that.
Jim's got me all wound up.
I know, Bill's over.
Thing.
Bill's new to the co-hosting. He used to just be having a fit out in the lobby, and then Elizabeth moved to Utah. Hi, Elizabeth. And Bill now has to try to, he's got to try to be fun and frivolous while we watch our...
I'm installing a breathing machine out there so I can...
watch our state burn to the ground.
I can get back.
Okay, so a quick question for you, Jim. I had somebody in the chat room like a half hour ago ask me where that teacher was, the perv you talked about that actually is now getting a fat retirement.
Yeah, I'll have to, well, first of all, get the book.
It's in the book.
The book's available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. They just need to type in Taxifornia into the search engine. But the event happened in the Los Angeles school system year before last, and the situation is that the teacher was a long-term teacher, and he was teaching grammar school kids. And the guy clearly had some sort of a psychological problem, and I'm not going to say to you what he did, but what he did was just perverse, and it was up to the. It didn't involve actual touching of the kids, but what he did was very wrong, and this guy now who should have been fired immediately. Was not fired immediately, and John Deasy, who was the superintendent of public instruction of the L.A. Unified School District, came in and looked at it and was able to use this guy's issue as a way to reform the board rules. And as a result, and I talk about it in the book, they were able to actually end up putting 300 teachers throughout the district on leave because they'd had so many similar complaints, not as egregious as what this guy did, but stuff of inappropriate behavior on the part of the teachers. Can you believe that?
Yeah. Is that leave with pay?
Of course.
Well, yeah. I mean, what they do is the way that the system works in L.A. County is that you get put on leave with pay. And then you go before a three-judge administrative panel. And one person on the panel is appointed by the union. Another person on the panel is appointed by the school district. And then you have a judge, chief judge, who's usually a teacher and a member of the union. So
that's,
you know, the
fair.
Outcomes usually are not so great. As we're talking, I'll try and thumb through the book and see if I can give you a little bit more direct information on it. But even reform-minded superintendents like John Deasy, who's a good guy, get terrible problems from the school district. Yeah, it's I can give you the details right now. It's on page 60 of my book. And I'll just read this to you. After a sex abuse scandal at Miramonte Elementary School, DC initiated a zero tolerance policy in February of 2012, and since then has sidelined 100 teachers for misconduct and accepted the resignations of 200 more that were about to be terminated. An astounding 300 additional teachers accused of inappropriate behavior have been taken out of the classroom while their cases are investigated. And I have a citation to a Los Angeles Daily News article. So, you know, I have over 800 footnotes in my book, and I'm not just pulling this out of thin air. These are absolutely truthful. And, you know, let me go on here. The actual dismissal of the offending teachers will be very tricky because, according to California's arcane teacher dismissal regulations, heavily influenced by CTA, a dismissal must be approved by a three-person administrative panel that includes not only an administrative law judge, but also a representative appointed by the school board and a third member appointed by the accused teacher or union representative. One keen observer has noted that the process usually results in a union-friendly panel process that has seen fewer than 10 dismissals for cause a year in the entire state. Out of 300,000 teachers and hundreds of cases annually. Can you believe that?
Hey, Jim, just to let people know, if you guys go to our website, if you go to wethepeopleradio.us, click on the book, it takes you immediately to Amazon to the link where you can get it. And that would be well worth it. Before we get into that a little further, we should bring on our we have somebody on the line on hold, so we ought to bring on Mark Baird, and then I think we have to try to fit another break in somehow before 9 o'clock. So, just to give everybody a little roadmap of the pressure cooker here, Mark, be in there.
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, there you go.
Oh, are you? Is it time for me to speak now?
You are it.
Okay. I have a couple of questions for your speaker. Number one, would it be advantageous if the Sims versus Reynolds decision were overturned so that California could return to a federal model of government and we would then have meaningful legislation in order to put a muzzle on these unions? And number two, What is your suggestion for getting back to the basics of a decent educational system that isn't breaking the taxpayers' back?
Well, starting with the second part, I think it's fairly simple. What we ought to be doing is having meaningful tests. Now, I've talked to some teachers, and teachers say, well, you know, in California we test too much. If you talk to teachers that you know, they'll say we have to administer the STAR test, we have to do this test, we have to do that test. Here's the problem. The problem is that they do all this testing, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just statistics. When I talk about meaningful testing, I mean meaningful testing to get a high school diploma. You know, a high school diploma should be a meaningful thing. And we shouldn't just keep pushing people through the system that end up being uneducated, and to the extent that some of those kids go on to junior college or to a regular four-year college, the statistics show that in California, almost all of them are unprepared, unless they've been at the very top of their academic achievement in the school. They've got to go to the colleges. They've got to go to Chico State or Cal State, and they have to relearn English so that they can and be put in remedial courses. That's not going to help the future of California. There's an outfit called the Lumina Foundation that has found that California is going to need people that have good, solid high school diplomas and high school level education and more for us to advance. So I think we need to make tests meaningful, and we need to judge teacher pay on the basis of student achievement. And if we do that, I think that we'll see the tests rise. On the other legal issue that you raise about the federalization, and the relationship with the unions, I guess I can't answer it so directly with respect to the case, because I can't say that I have the case at the top of my head. But I can say this. I think that unions really, since the RODA Act was passed, which goes back to 1974, just as Reagan had came out of being governor, it was signed by Jerry Brown. The California Teachers Association has really had a monopoly on representation of teachers in the state. And I really do think that if that was rethought, and if there was some volunteerism put back into the system so that teachers could think of themselves more as professionals than as, quote, workers, that it would lift the impression that teachers have of themselves, and perhaps create a better thinking on the part of how people in general feel about the teaching profession, taking it out of the, you know, this worker adversarial environment that is so geared towards being grubby and grabbing for these benefits and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and that's become really, really clear here lately.
Yeah. Jim, do you think it would help also when you talk about these three-person panels that they have to adhere to? You put some parents on those panels instead of union people on those panels. That would make the teachers a little bit more aware of their lack of ability to contain their job.
No, we definitely need to do everything we possibly can that gets more parent involvement. But, you know, the teachers union, they only want the parents basically to go out and raise money so that they have supplemental sources of income. And even when they do that, if they're too successful, the teachers' unions get upset. I write in the book about how in Malibu, which is part of the Malibu Santa Monica school system, that the parents had gone out and they did a tremendous job of raising funds locally, and they built a science lab in the Malibu schools, and kids were going out there and they were learning, they were scoring well in their achievement. And then what happened is that the school district board of directors, because of the union, got all upset by it because they didn't think that enough money was going into the Santa Monica part of the school district, where parents didn't care as much to raise money. And so what they did was they basically nationalized the fundraising, and they said, okay, well, you parents up in Malibu, you're raising fund for your schools. We're going to take half of what you raise, and we're going to bring it down to Santa Monica and force you to spend it on schools that your kids don't even go to.
Unbelievable.
And, of course, what happened is that the program began to shut down, you know, because of these ridiculous notions of social equality. You know, the bottom line in all of this is that we really do need to be thinking rationally about our schools. And part of that is to ensure that we have good critical thinking skills taught in math and reading, that we have meaningful testing, and that we find ways to motivate teachers to actually teach and to not just think of themselves as part of some, you know, a manufacturing assembly process that just ends up resulting in them getting the biggest pension at the end of the day.
True. All right. We've got to take a really quick break here and then another quick break. So we have a little pile up on the freeway of advertisement. Anyway, thanks a lot for joining Jim Lacey when we return here at We the People Radio.
And the sky is gray. I've been for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be safe and warm if I was in L.A.
At the junior college where we majored in beer and girls. It was all real funny till we ran out of money and they threw us out into the world.
Welcome back, everybody.
All right, you're back with We the People Radio for another 15 seconds here. And then we have 5 minutes of news. Like I said, we had a little pile up here on the freeway. Okay, so I'll just give you a little bit of information. Next week we have Michael Walsh, who wrote a book called Rules for Radical Conservatives. The week after, we have economist Lawrence Spivak, and then Tim Daughtry, Waking the Sleeping Giant. So we've got some good lineup coming for you. After this program, we have Sovereign Minds with Linda and Mark Kent, which is in their new time slot. One other thing we need to cram in, fundraiser for this show and Sovereign Minds on March 8th. Please watch the website. Be right back with Jim Lacey, author of Taxifornia.
Welcome back, everybody. You're joining We the People Radio with Aaron and Bill
and Jim. Bob
and Bob.
Yeah. We're in hour two here, and you can find, if you've missed the first hour, you're going to feel like you kind of came in halfway through the movie, but you can catch up. We make it easy for you. Go to wethepeopleradio.us. You've got a link to the book we're speaking about. It's Taxifornia, written by James V. Lacey. We get to call him Jim, though, because now he's our special friend. anyway, it's the Liberals' Laboratory to Bankrupting America. So, you know, I think everybody up here at the northern end of the state, Jim, we all really get that, which is why you're seeing so much activity on the State of Jefferson movement. And I know Mark Baird from that project is going to call us back here in a little bit, so maybe he can give us a little 2-minute overview, and we'll get your take on that.
Sure.
But Bill had needs.
Yeah, what can you tell us about the the gas tax, and you know, it was my understanding that that tax was to be used to help or solely to maintain our roads and highways, and I understand that's not exactly what's happening with that with those
moves. No, it's not. It's being used as just another resource on behalf of the state. The gas tax is set by the State Board of Equalization, and it can be affected, obviously, by legislation by the state legislature. But this is one of the reasons why we need to be following as citizens who gets elected to these positions that maybe not be quite as obvious to us as a member of the United States Senate or as a member of Congress. But after the Proposition 30 tax increases went into place and we had the highest state income tax and the highest state sales tax as a result, the Board of Equalization, by a 3-2 vote, increased the excise tax on fuel at the pump. So combined state taxes on gasoline in California are the highest in the nation. And within a few pennies, it comes to roughly around 75 cents a gallon. Well, you know, if you start to figure that out, that's about 20% of the cost of a gallon of gasoline is just state tax. Where this is really bad is the effect that it has on our poorer citizens. And to be frank, I was astounded. I went to a conference at Pepperdine University Law School on taxation, and a fellow named Joseph Bankman, who is a professor at Stanford University, was one of the presenters, and we brought up the issue of this gas tax, and he said, well, you know, I testified to the legislature and to the Board of Equalization in favor of raising this tax because this is a tax that can be very helpful in terms of raising funds for the state. But at the same time, I got the guy to admit that it has a terrible effect on poor Californians. They had information that showed that in the Central Valley, some people who are struggling financially pay as much as 10% of their income for transportation. That's for gasoline or bus fare or other forms of transportation that would involve using fuel. Well, if you're paying 10% of your income for transportation and 20% of the cost of your fuel is state tax, it's pretty easy to see that that tax moves the needle in pushing you deeper into poverty. And we have this very bad unemployment problem in the Central Valley. It's worse there. It's 10% plus. And we have a lot of our people who are living in poverty in our state are in this same particular area. So what the Democrats have done through the gas tax and also through the sales tax, and I want to talk about that with you for a second, they've enacted consumption taxes which force people deeper into poverty. We should not have the highest poverty rate in the nation, but it may come as no surprise, as we've talked here for the last hour about these policies, about the liberal Democrats, about why California has become the poorest nation in the state. When I was in junior high, my family had a travel trailer. I lived in the Bay Area, and we loved to go up to Mount Shasta. And I had mentioned to Aaron in an email many times, fish the McLeod River, and before the spill, you know, fished in Dunsmuir and enjoyed the wonderful weather there and enjoyed going out and taking the .22 and shooting out where we could legally do that. We really enjoyed very much the time that we spent in your area. But, you know, subsequently, when Oregon got rid of their state sales tax, and California didn't respond by creating some sort of a zone to protect particularly small businesses, small retail establishments in your extreme northern end of the state, we saw economic devastation, don't you think? Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what type of a state would we have that wouldn't somehow figure out a creative way to respond by perhaps creating some sort of economic zone that would protect the small businesses by softening the impact there. Well, it's not for want of trying, I guess, on the part of right-thinking people to keep the taxation low. But from my standpoint, I would say that state government, particularly because of the devastation of small businesses over the last generation in Northern California, specifically because of this tax issue, have pretty much abandoned the idea of free enterprise and job creation in that respect. And I think it's been derelict and wrong. And I know you want to go over and talk about Jefferson. I don't talk about succession or creation of new states in my book. I do think that there are some possibilities for salvation of California in the future, but I'm not going to be Pollyannish about it. I really understand why people are upset, and it's part of the reason that motivates me to write my book. And frankly, I believe that there's probably a lot of information in my book that the people that support Jefferson not only would agree with, but would use to help justify their position. I mean, I can say firsthand, I've seen it. I used to go up to Weed and Yreka, and, you know, before we had these problems, and I saw beautiful small towns that had vibrant main streets and that had great small businesses that catered to the locals and that also were available to the tourists that would come up in the summer to take advantage of the area. And the last time I was in the area, I was just so saddened to drive through Dunsmuir and to see, you know, what used to be a much more vibrant city kind of having gone to, you know, gone to bed, gone to sleep. And I really respect the North area, but I think that government action has been an inaction has had a lot to do with the with the problems there.
Well, Prop 215 helped help the folks in Dunsmuir go down the drain. Hey, let's get Mark on here in case he has in case he's not going to hang with us the whole time. Uh-oh. And his phone's ringing.
No, it's okay. Somebody else will get to
the phone. Are you at the radio station?
Yeah, I wanted to say that I think that, first of all, I mean, I'm going to order that book, and as soon as I get off the air here, I'm gonna order your book and read it cover to cover. I think you're right on about 100% of the things you're talking about. But I suggest that in the North State, as much as for inland California and rural California in general, this started in 1965 when the Warren Court deprived us of the federal model of government, when counties lost the ability to be represented in the United States Senate after the Sims versus Reynolds decision, and we went to a one-man, one-vote for both Senate and Assembly. At that point, Californians, both houses became, in a sense, rubber stamps for one another. That's when the debt started going up. That's when the taxes started increasing dramatically. That's when we really began to move toward a one-party system in California. And I think that supports your assertions that the taxes are out of control. And they are out of control because we lost the ability to represent ourselves by area. And so our answer to that, unless we can overturn that Supreme Court decision and bring California back to a federal model where each county has a Senate representative, our only option is to separate from California and institute that model in the North State ourselves. I think that Common Core is to blame. I think that legislative malfeasance is to blame. I think undereducated legislature, a legislature is to blame because they, quite frankly, don't know us, don't know how we live, don't know how hard it is for us to make a living, and do nothing to help us do those things. I think that politics in California is now driven by the Southland, and their interest is one way. It is to gain the resources that we have and use them for their benefit at the expense of the people who live next to the river, if you will. And I think that the state of Jefferson is a very real attempt to change that using constitutional processes. And failing that, we will attack Sims versus Reynolds and try to pull the rug out from under establishment California politics.
Yeah.
we like it.
Well, the idea of representative democracy and representing at the local level, I think, is fundamental to our Constitution. I also happen to be a lawyer, and I have worked in the federal government, and I have litigated First Amendment and some constitutional cases. And the contrary argument, as you know, from a constitutional standpoint, is the so-called one man, one vote principle, and whether or not the creation of local jurisdictions somehow has an effect of diluting the one man, one vote. And they get into these tortured analyses that really are more applicable to situations in the old Jim Crow South, where there might have been attempts by elected officials to dilute the voting strength of minorities. And so you get these precedents in the area of voter representation that end up being applied to states like California, but were created in completely different circumstances, you know, involving discrimination in Alabama or Mississippi or one of the southern states. And this is where it ends up getting a little bit complicated. Yes, I do recall that we did have a system where counties would be represented in the Senate, and I think that the term limit law probably hasn't worked well in terms of increasing local representation. You know, the idea of passing the term limit law was so that you wouldn't have these entrenched politicians like former Speaker Willie Brown in office for 15, 20, or 30 years, and then have that official become distant from the people and more responsive to the lobbyists that they dealt with in Sacramento. So the idea was to have more of a citizen legislature through the so-called term limits law, and it seems that the term limits law, which has now been, you know, it's now been amended to allow members to serve for as long as 12 years, but it seems like the term limits law had put some distance between the elected officials and the populace, because the people in the assembly were serving in such short terms. So I get all that and I understand it. But I truly believe that the North State, from my own experiences with it, has in many ways been abandoned by Sacramento. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. I can see through my own eyes from such a contrast, and to be quite honest with you, I just don't understand it. The part of the state that we're talking about is one that is not only characterized by terrific scenic beauty, but it's also characterized by a great deal of production that helps support the state as a whole. And it's not just the resources like water or other mineral resources, but it's the agriculture, tremendous agriculture production that benefits everybody in the state. It benefits payrolls, it benefits paying taxes, and so on. So, you know, I can really understand how the citizenry might feel in the northern part of the state in terms of abandonment. And by bringing government more local and getting closer to how government is functioning, you can end up getting outcomes that are more reflective of what the people want. So, you know, that's my two cents about it. I don't know that we're going to be able to overturn any particular federal law in the state that's going to result in a change in representation. We've just gone through a reapportionment. We've got this new initiative where we have this impartial panel, so-called impartial panel, that, you know, that has done the reapportionment of the districts. You know, all I know is that the political system seems really stilted against local representation. It certainly seems stilted against moderate and conservative candidates running for partisan offices in the state, and I think we're in terrible shape.
Exactly.
Well,
All right, we need to take
I agree, and thank you so much for your book. I'm going to go out and buy it, and thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Mark. And for those of you that have questions about the state of Jefferson and need more information there, we're not going to make the rest of the show about that, just because otherwise we won't learn anything about Jim's information here. But you can find that at jeffersondeclaration.net. And there are a lot of videos there. You may not find it all in print, but you will find it via video. And I do believe there are links for Q&A for more information.
Great. And with that, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, Jim, I would like to talk about our budget surplus we have in California. Because I understand we're totally out of debt now, and I'm really excited about that. And I hope you can expand on that a little bit.
I'm going to get Bill his free unicorn while we're on break here. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.net. And we'll see you in the chat room.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart. Give a damn
everybody. We the People Radio. We're speaking to Jim Lacey, and we're talking about his new book, Taxifornia. Hey, Jim, I heard Jerry Brown talking the other day about our budget surplus and cautioning our lawmakers down in Sacramento not to get all excited and go out and spend it frivolously and save it for a rainy day.
They wouldn't do that.
No, I know
they hate spending frivolously. They're very prudent with their money.
Yeah, I don't think lecturing them was a good idea at all. But I'm kind of under the impression that we're in the middle of a big storm right now, and I really don't think we have a surplus. But maybe you can explain how they come up with that.
Well, the whole notion of a surplus in the state raises two conflicting issues. And I'm glad we have a little bit of time to talk about this. One is, how can you have a surplus when the Sacramento Bee says that you've got somewhere between $648 billion and $1.1 trillion in unfunded pension liability debt statewide, including local governments?
Yeah, we don't need to worry about that right now, though.
How can you possibly say that a $2 or $3 billion so-called surplus exists when you have all of those liabilities, when you've got a teacher's pension plan alone that's probably underfunded close to $100 billion, and then when you have the state public employees' pension plan, which is probably underfunded by more than $100 billion. So that's one question. The flip side of the coin is this. If we accept Governor Brown's statement that they have a surplus, well, why are we taxing the way we are? We're obviously overtaxing if we have a surplus because governments are nonprofit entities. They're not profit entities. They're not supposed to make profits. A surplus is like a profit. If you have a surplus, it means you need to do two things. A, you need to lower taxes so the next year you won't have a surplus. And B, you need to consider the moral obligation to rebate the excess tax revenue to the taxpayers. And you know that's exactly what Republican Governor George Dugmasian did in 1987. Proposition 13 had passed in 1978. The taxes went down. There was an economic renewal in the state as a result of it. Within 4 or 5 years, the state revenues were back to where they were at pre-Proposition 13 levels. The economy boomed, and by 1987, the state had a windfall of more revenue than it needed to pay for its budget. And what did George Dukmejian do? He worked with the legislature, and every taxpayer in the state that paid taxes got a rebate check of 15% of what their tax payment was. So, to take it back to Jerry Brown, I say this. If there is a surplus, which there isn't, follow my reasoning?
Mm-hmm.
If there is a surplus, which we know there isn't, stop using the word surplus, because for you to be able to use the word surplus, the next words out of your mouth should be, and it's time for a tax cut, or it's time to rebate the excess funds the government doesn't deserve.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because on the one hand, you hear Brown talking about that. And then on the other, I don't remember where I read it, but, you know, state treasurer is like, not so fast. And then you start looking at the propositions that are lining up for us. I mean, it's like we're totally just schizophrenic.
Yeah, the state auditor has
really
put out some very disturbing economic analysis of the state, and even, as you say, the state treasurer, Bill Lockyer, came out and said that he felt that in a very short period of time, the California State Teachers Pension Fund would collapse unless it had a significant infusion of funds. But you know how they work in Sacramento. I'm sure that the teachers union was probably looking at that $2 billion surplus or $3 billion or whatever flavor it is of the day on the part of Brown and saying, well, we want to grab some of that for our own unfunded pension liability. You know, the problem is that the Liberal Democrats have been far too generous with these pensions to begin with.
Yeah.
Gray Davis and the Democrats in the legislature in 1999 basically screwed up the whole process by increasing by over 50% the benefits that would be provided to public employees. They didn't need to do that. They could have been more careful, but it was a different time. It was different economic conditions, and there were different expectations about how much money the actuarials would be able to make in terms of the investments. The, you know, the whole issue of the pensions is, A, how much the taxpayers will put in to support the pensions, B, what type of a rate of return the people that are managing the funds will get, and C, whether or not there will be investments by the employees themselves back into the fund. And then the whole thing is also judged by the idea of a single payout. In other words, that it's not something that is like a 401k where you just see it grow or go down and then you decide how much you're going to pull out. It's a defined benefit plan. The defined benefit plans that we have are way too generous. Do you know that we have over 20,000 retirees right now in the state system that are making over $100,000 a year just in pensions?
Wow.
So you can see, well, those numbers add up, and while our society grows older and people are living longer and less money is going into the system, and where we have had an economic downturn where you just can't expect that you're going to get 8 or 9% on your investment, that system is just going to implode upon itself unless something's done. And there are efforts to try and reform. Chuck Reed in San Jose has been trying to get a initiative on the ballot, but he's been fought tooth and nail on all the technicalities to try and get it on the ballot to reform pensions. And what it would basically do is it would reform pensions for new people coming into the system and simply require that that people already in the system might make a little bit more of a contribution on their own part. But these reform measures are fought tooth and nail by the public employee unions. And the problem that we have with these unions is that they're not thinking about society in general. They're not looking after the people. They're looking after their members. And we have a situation where there's far too much selfishness on the part of these unions. The BART pay scales, as we've said earlier, are a perfect example of taking advantage of the people. Even in Oakland, the city of Oakland a couple of years ago, had a one-day strike, and some of the union employees, electrical workers, I believe, were quoted as saying, you know, we need a living wage. We've got to get people to support a living wage. And these were employees who are making $120,000 a year under their union contract.
Yeah, that's
and
crazy.
They wanted more.
And you know, I would have thought that after Detroit, that would have been a giant wake-up call for some of these unions to start implementing some reforms. But, man, that all just fell on deaf ears. I don't really hardly believe that the federal government is going to step in and bail these unions out. Look at Detroit. They're not going to do it there. And
yeah,
there's going to be a lot of people.
California state government might, you know, in the case of Stockton, the largest municipal bankruptcy in the history of the United States prior to Detroit was Stockton. And why did Stockton go bankrupt? Because it had a bunch of liberal people that were elected to their city council that were simply giving into the unions, and they were doing crazy spending. You know, the city of Stockton built a ice hockey rink with public funds and bonds that they put out to Wall Street when they didn't even have a team to play there. You know what precipitated Stockton going into bankruptcy court? The bank repossessed City Hall. That's a fact that I write about in my book.
At that point, it's like, ruh-roh.
Yeah.
Hey, we better take a really quick break here. I forgot. We're going to have the train wreck again. So this will avert the train wreck. We'll thank our advertisers here for 2 minutes. Everybody gets to take a breath. We have a caller on the line, so we'll be action-packed when we return here at We the People Radio. We're speaking with our friend Jim Lacey, all about taxifornia.
We'll be back. We have a caller on the line. Terry, you got a quick question for us?
Oops.
Oh, what happened?
We have to actually put you in a spot where you can talk.
Ask him again.
Terry, are you there? You got a quick question for us?
Yeah, I have two quick questions. The first one is we've heard a lot of what's going on, and my question is about solutions. With the Reynolds versus Sims situation and the situation of California, one-third of it, being represented by only two senators and three assemblymen, Los Angeles County alone has 11 senators and 24 assemblymen. How do we get representation in our views, number one? And number two, with the debt clock showing now in California 2 years ago being $150 billion in debt, we're now almost $420 billion in debt, and we have $900 billion worth of unfunded liability, which gives us a debt of $1.3 trillion. How do we come out the other end, and what are the solutions that you have for California? And thanks again for being on, and I'm going to get your book, too. There's a lot of good stuff in there. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Terry.
Thanks, Terry.
Sure. Thank you, Terry. Thank you very much. Great questions. You know, I didn't write the book with the idea of mapping out solutions. My purpose in writing the book was to demonstrate how truly bad things are and to put the blame squarely where it belonged on liberal Democrats that control this state and the public employee unions who prop them up and who get them elected. I do discuss potential solutions, and some of the solutions are pretty rational. Arnold Schwarzenegger, in my opinion, failed to reform California, and I have a whole chapter about that. But one thing his administration did do was compile something called the California Performance Review, which is over 2,000 pages of recommendations based on a very substantial audit of the state. They're real common sense solutions. When Meg Whitman ran for governor, she said that she read the California Performance Review twice, and she said, well, these are no-brainers. There are very simple solutions that would save the state a lot of money, for example, in the Department of Motor Vehicles. Rather than registering your car for 1 year, register it for 2 years. That would cut by 50% the costs of registration for those people that were going to have their car for more than a year. I mean, this is not rocket science. There's hundreds of recommendations along those lines in the California Performance Review. The problem was that Schwarzenegger didn't want to, at the end of the day, do the courageous thing, which would have been to take on the state legislature and have a fight. He was more concerned about his reputation. I have to say this. I do get what you're saying about the lack of representation and how much the representation is indeed stilted towards some areas. But we do have a history in California of the people rising up.
Mm-hmm.
The people rose up in 1978 and got behind a crusty old man named Howard Jarvis, and they cut their property taxes by 57%. Even in the face of the business community and all the elected officials, including the Liberal Democrats, saying that Proposition 13 wasn't going to work. In 2003, we recalled a sitting Liberal Democrat governor, Gray Davis, and we did it because of the car tax. He raised taxes. Now, at the end of the day, the recall of Gray Davis ended up being flubbed because we put the wrong person in as governor who didn't follow through and cut taxes. And, you know, at the end of Schwarzenegger's term, his chief of staff was the same person who was Gray Davis's chief of staff. Her name is Susan Davis.
That's heartwarming.
She was a former executive director of the California Democratic Party. Don't let anybody tell you Arnold was a Republican. He really wasn't.
No, we're busy ripping him on the chat room right now, actually.
Yeah. There's no way I defend him. My chapter's called Arnold Schwarzenegger's Failure to Reform California. But I'm not Pollyannish. I'm not optimistic about the future of California. I think it might take a generation. The California Republican Party's in terrible shape. But I have to tell you, I have seen signs that I think are positive. In the Los Angeles municipal elections less than a year ago, a ballot proposition that would have raised the sales tax in the city of Los Angeles in order to pay for more police and fire union demands was defeated by a vote of 55% to 45%. Now, Los Angeles is a big city. It's a Democrat city. And the voters in that city had enough of taxes, and they voted against that tax. And not enough has been said in the press about that fact. In Richmond last year, which is a largely minority community dominated by black Americans, the city voted down a soda tax. El Monte, which is largely a Hispanic community in Southern California, on the same ballot voted down a soda tax. It may very well be that waking up California depends upon the tax and depends upon how far the Liberal Democrats push us. You know, this transgender bathroom bill might be a question that of the Liberal Democrats pushing too hard that comes back to bite them. I don't know. It might take a generation. Certainly a big part of it is that the Republican Party needs to broaden its leadership, and it needs to broaden and embrace more minorities. It just absolutely has to, because those are the changing demographics of California. And the Democratic Party needs to get a little bit wise. The Democratic Party is going to eventually, one way or another, be found to be responsible for all of these failures. And if they don't wake up, particularly in the area of education, and start listening to other Democrats in their own party, like Gloria Romero and Michelle Rhee, about reforming education, we're going to end up with a situation where we have, more than one generation of undereducated, underachieving young people that have gone through an expensive educational process that are not going to be helping the rest of the state in the future.
Well, they won't be able to live here. I mean, they can barely, if you go away to college and you come back home, at this point in time, the idea of being self-sufficient, buying a home, those kinds of things, that's totally unattainable for 99% of the people, I would imagine.
Absolutely it is. You know, I saw that an apartment for two with two bedrooms in San Francisco now is roughly $3,000 a month, Well, the average
and you
pay
have to live in San Francisco.
the average pay in San Francisco is $120,000. So, you know, what's happening to our state to be able to live in San Francisco? You got to be really well off. You know, it's like the middle class is being pushed out, and the problem that we have is that the only people that are really doing good, I might at risk of repeating myself now, the only people that are really doing well in the state, other than those in Silicon Valley and some people in the entertainment industry, the only people really doing well are the members of the public employee unions that are imposing their economic priorities on the rest of us so that they can get more and more. Do you know that in the BART strike, I'm sure you covered this, what was going on, that one of the issues that the union put on the table in the BART strike was that the unions didn't want to agree to use email unless it went through labor arbitration?
Wow.
Did you know that?
No. No,
we didn't. The way that the checks were delivered to employees under the last contract was as that if the employees were at some remote location, they would have couriers bring them their checks. So what the BART management wanted to do was to have direct deposit, and they wanted to have email exchanges on how they paid the employees, and the BART union balked at that and said, no, we want to use a pencil and a paper to be able to send that back into you about that would justify how people are paid, so that's how the checks would be developed. It was absolutely ridiculous. The unions don't want to take something as simple as using commonly used technology now, i.e. email, without making it into some sort of a labor dispute where they can get leverage to get more money or more benefits out of society. It's absolutely awful.
And, I think people are starting to wise up to that, too. I mean, these guys are making so much money on the backs of the public, and anytime there's a little hiccup, they want to strike. I think people are getting fed up with it.
They are getting fed up with it. However, if they don't, same as always, if people don't go to the polls, if they don't step up, if they don't get involved in some of this, it is never going to change.
Yeah, just complaining about it's not going to get it done.
All right, swift break. We'll be right back, and we'll finish out the top of the hour with our friend Jim Lacey, author of Taxifornia, here on We the People Radio.
I wish I worked for BART.
I came here looking for something I couldn't find anywhere else. But I don't want to be nobody, just want a chance to be myself. I've done 1,000 miles of thumbing, guess I've worn blisters on my heels. Trying to find me something better on the streets of Bakersfield.
We're back, folks. Hey, you know, if you like what you're hearing, you like conservative talk radio, join us at our fundraiser on March 8th. We're going to be at Wind River, and you can email us for tickets at, give me an email address.
How about bill@wethepeopleradio.us?
Oh, yeah, that's my email address.
Or Erin, E-R-I-N, @wethepeopleradio.us. We'll get you all the info. It's going to be fun. We have gun auctions. We have a dessert auction. Linda Kent's been working her buns off. I know in the next hour she will give you all the details. But it's going to be fun. It was fun last year. It pays for the shows for like an entire year, so we don't have to do a bunch of fundraising and all that. And since we are, we're politically controversial. A lot of businesses don't necessarily want to be tied to us financially.
Yeah.
It's
kind of
a bummer.
They'll all be tied to us eventually.
We're keeping the ship afloat, but we get it. So anyway, attend the fundraiser. It's fun. And with that, we are back with our guest, Jim Lacey. All right, I want to make sure I get it right. Taxifornia is the name of the book. The Liberals' Laboratory to Bankrupt America. And if that just ain't the truth, Jim, that's like the best title in the universe. I think I saw it like, I don't know where I saw your book. Saw it somewhere. And I thought, we got to have that guy online.
You know, the bankruptcy just isn't about tax dollars either. It's about our way of life, really. Today's Sunday, and I'm thinking about going, after we finish up here, I'm going to go home and get my wife, and we're going to go to church. California is a remarkably religious state. We're quiet about it, but over 50% of our state answers surveys saying that they affiliate with a religion, and of course most of those who say they affiliate with a religion in the state are Christian. Yet we have this discrimination, really, that liberal Democrats put against even the most passive displays of faith, including the Christian faith. And in my book, I write about the very sad story that occurred in Northern California at Sonoma State University last year, where a 19-year-old student was helping at freshman orientation. And she showed up at the freshman orientation wearing a small cross necklace.
Oh, yeah, we heard
That's
about
right.
that.
And the state officials there ordered her to remove it because, in their opinion, they felt that it would offend some of the incoming students and make them feel unwelcome. So her supervisor actually told her to hide the cross under her shirt or remove it. And, of course, what she did was she did the right thing. She quit the job and she made it public. The reason this occurred was because the chancellor of the school, who's another highly paid state employee, felt that it was an appropriate policy to have a rule against the display of religious symbols. But how passive a religious symbol could something be as simple as wearing a small cross? I mean, my God, I've seen Madonna wear crosses, and, you know, and perhaps that was not done for exactly a religious devotional reason, but how innocuous could be just having a passive little cross that you're wearing around your neck, and to tell that 19-year-old girl that she can't wear that, who probably didn't have a second thought about doing anything other than welcoming new kids to the school. This is a result of the misguided thinking of liberals that that we have to have such a politically correct society that people can't even have their constitutional rights under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution and the California Constitution to have a freedom of religion. So I get into that just a little bit in the book because I think it's appropriate, you know, to mention it. It's not just tax and spending that we need to be thinking about as a problem in California. We need to be thinking about how closed and one-sided and biased our society is becoming. We really need to be a much more open society, particularly when it comes to expression of religious rights.
Well, I think we're seeing that more and more often, which is why talk radio is just a huge venue for, you know, conservative opinion. Because obviously the television media seems to be pretty heavily slanted.
Yeah, and a huge target. Hey, Jim, is your book available on Kindle?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I saw that.
Yeah, it's available on Kindle through Amazon.com, and it's in hardback at Amazon.com. It's also available in a Nook ebook version at BarnesandNoble.com, and then the hardback is at BarnesandNoble.com. It's I've been blessed that it's been on the bestseller list for Politico.com for the last 3 weeks. So political junkies are liking the book and purchasing it and reading it. That's great. And it's only been out since January 7th, so it's starting to filter its way through the distribution system into the so-called brick-and-mortar stores, but the best way to get it right now is through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com.
Outstanding, because, you know, that's one of the things, you know, people that are spending a lot of time lamenting what's going on in California, we really have to get educated. We're not going to make a great change unless we're smarter than the opposition.
Well, I'll tell you that what's good about the Kindle version is that if you put it on your laptop or you put it on your mobile device, there's 800 footnotes, and if you can actually press the footnote and it will come up in your browser, the URL, so that you'll have the original source material that I used to write
great.
The book. So if someone's giving speeches or out speaking to the public, they've got a really good resource available to them on the Kindle version.
Oh, my gosh, that's awesome. And, you know, anybody who is wishing that they either heard the whole thing or wants to send this to somebody else, if you go to wethepeopleradio.us on the website there right now is everything about this book, everything about Jim, and you can forward that page to somebody else. If you have missed it and you're listening to this a little bit later, the index page actually has the link to the archive of the show. And we hope you'll use it, Jim, to promote things for the future for your book. If that's of any use to you, you're welcome to it.
Well, Aaron and Bill, I just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you today, and thank you for what you guys do with We the People Radio. It's terrific.
We had a short conversation that maybe it would be too much time, and I'm like, no, it won't be too much time.
We could do this for another 2 hours. There's just so much information to cover. It's crazy. It's just crazy. People need to get the facts and figure out why this stuff is going on in California. And you're right. Put the blame where the blame belongs.
Yep.
Thanks, Jim.
Now, thank you very much for the opportunity.
No, we totally love it. And so, we're like a minute early. Any
Let me ask
thought?
You a question. Yeah. How's the level of the McLeod? Is it down as a result of the drought?
Everything's kind of down,
I think everything's down. We got a storm here. Well, I say a storm. I think we got about a half an inch of rain out of it.
It all evaporated on the way to the ground.
There's just no snowpack either, so it's going to be really tough this summer. It's going to be tough for everybody in California. The water is just not going to be there.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that they're stopping permitting fishing in many of the rivers and streams.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because of it, we did get some nice rain over the course of the last couple days, but, you know, the policy solutions that we're getting out of Sacramento to deal with it are
absolutely
terrible. And the only thing that's going to save them is if we can get weather, you know.
Exactly.
I guess, you know, we really need to get the rain to, you know, to come in.
All right. We have about 30 seconds. So thank you, Jim, for coming on.
Thank you very much for coming on,
and,
Jim.
And, you know, if you have more thoughts or write anything new, you've got our info. Call us.
All right. Well, you guys keep at it. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Next week, we're on with Michael Walsh, Rules for Radical Conservatives. It'll be super fun.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Bob.
This is KCNR Shasta Redding.